This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. We are with Ryler Dustin, and he is the winner of the University of Pittsburgh Agnes Lynch Starrett Award for 2023, and he is going to prove it to you with an opening poem. Here's Ryler.
All right, I'll start with the title poem of my book, Grace, and that's Trailer Park Psalm. Bless us, Lord of corrugated tin, of crooked windows held against the wind with mold, dark duct tape, of roofs repaired in rain that would not let up. Bless us, Lord, of all that patches, holds, is good enough. Plywood, foil, fast dry foam, my grandma's hands that worked our wood stove chimney back to shape. Bless us, Lord, of the mildewed scent my grandma raised me in, of carpets singed by cigarettes, ashtrays made from Folgers tins, hamburger helper and discount meat in cedar-shadowed kitchens. Bless us, Lord, as we were back then, a pack of knobby boys on bikes, girls with creosote-lined eyes and smiles slick with gloss. Bless our uncooked Northwest skins, ghost white except for Ian's, who called out how white man and punched whoever laughed. Bless Jake, his red hair lighting the street on the night his trailer burned. He fled with his bike, a bag of CDs, his stepdad's 44. Bless Jory, whose twin sisters died and came back as raccoons. Bless John, who chewed dry cat food as he swaggered up the gravel strip. Bless blackberries, fat with summer rain, dark as blood from the thumbs we pricked. Bless bracken, birch, Douglas fir, the nettle's electric ache. Bless the sword fern's dusty seeds that ease a nettle's sting. Bless the cedars we climbed at dusk until our trailers looked like toys. Bless Rick in the woods with his butterfly knife, slicing only rain, unfolding his blade with flourishes he gave religious names. Heaven's sword, angel's teeth, handshake with God. Bless the possums who spoke in tongues at night in the neighbor's trash. Bless Dick, eyes emptied by a war we were too young to know, who guarded the mail, cigarette unlit, always on patrol. Bless the dark of North Shore Road, where Jake hid as his trailer burned, where his mother had crashed their pickup truck in snow the year before. Bless the furs that tried to stop her. Bless Jake, Lord. He went to war. Bless Jory, who left for Mexico. And Ian, who said he was heading west, though we lived as west as you could go.
That is the voice of Ryler Dustin. And if you start with a blessing, you make everything beautiful, even trailers who look like toys, until our trailers looked like toys. So we're calling you in from the Pacific Northwest. And what's it like at this moment in your life there in Bellingham, Washington?
It's wonderful. I grew up here as these poems kind of are all set in this area. And I honestly didn't know that I would have the chance to move back. You know, my wife and I are both academics. And so, as is so often the case, you know, we were kind of prepared to just go wherever we could find jobs. And she managed to find a job here at the university in town. And we just moved back. It's coming up on a year since we moved back here. So, you know, it's kind of wild because the book kind of illustrates the speaker's journey away from the Northwest and then kind of returning to the area and reconciling with some of the elements of the past here that the early poems in the book explore. And that was, you know, I wrote all of that really before I knew I would come back here. And so the poem, you know, the book came out, you know, shortly after we moved back, and I was able to kind of share it with the communities that got me started writing.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's been beautiful to be back here.
It's a beautiful unity. complete now. Are you at the University of Washington?
My wife is at Western Washington University, up in Bellingham here, and I'm kind of looking for work still. I just sort of landed. I'm doing various remote, you know, writing, instruction, job.
Oh, that's wonderful. We really want you in any variation we can get you. Well, I lived in Whidbey Island.
Oh, wow.
A couple of times. And so I know the feeling, but it was only sunny in August. So I have a little problem with that. So we would love to know why you think that you won this prestigious University of Pittsburgh Agnes Lynch Starrett Award. I mean, it's as good as you get. What do you think they said about you? What are they like?
Gosh, I mean, that's a great question. That's a question I've been asking myself, of course, because, you know, I was so stunned and delighted to be chosen for the prize. You know, I think that Pittsburgh it was one of the first presses I really loved, and I really followed the press and read a lot of the poets who they, you know, kind of helped launch, from Sharon Olds to Larry Levis to, you know, Ross Gay's work and Danusha Lamaris, and so many amazing poets.
Now you're in the canon.
Yeah, right.
Tell us just one thing they said about your work.
Gosh.
One thing they said. It might be on the back of your book.
Yeah, you know, so really, I was fortunate to have a lot of other writers who were excited to blurb my work. So no one from Pittsburgh is actually on the back of the book. But, you know, they I spoke with Jeffrey McDaniel, who was the judge who selected this.
Oh.
And that in itself was incredible, because when I was a young spoken word artist and slam poet, and you know, I know, you know, we can talk about that later if you're interested, but I fell in love through the slam community with poetry and
yes, he's from Washington.
Yeah.
We knew him. He used to be our big slam person.
Yeah, I mean, and he, when I was coming up in the slam scene, he was kind of a legend, you know, he wasn't really around, but people would whisper his name a lot. And I remember, you know, one of kind of my slam early heroes, a spoken word artist named Buddy Wakefield, gave me Jeffrey McDaniel's book kind of in the back of this bar somewhere and was like, you need to read this. And so he was one of the, you know, first poets I ever loved, was Jeffrey McDaniel.
Did you like talking to him?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it was astonishing, because the judging was, you know, secret. They didn't announce who the judge was for that year that I won. So I was kind of stunned that I won. And then even more stunned than when they told me, oh, the judge is Jeffrey McDaniel, this person who, when I was like 21, you know, was this hero of mine. And of course, you know, he was a very personable, like, sounded very high energy and excited about poetry. And
well, you know, anytime that you start the world with blessings, something good is going to come back to you, I am sure. And we can't wait to hear it. Give us two together so we get to know who Ryler really is.
Okay. Well, I'll share these two poems that are also from the earlier part of the book and are kind of continue to be about this place, Bellingham. And the first poem is kind of about a tragedy that took place in my childhood and that affected the community here. And the second poem is sort of about the beginning of my journey, I suppose, kind of beyond the world that I knew, which, as is the case for many of us, was kind of launched through romantic love and discovering kind of, you know, a wider sense of self through that. So this first poem is called A Secret. If a boy's palm curls to cup the whisper of flame, if he stands passing a butane lighter back and forth with his friend, it is to learn how beauty burns the fingers, how the forbidden holds inside of it the holy. The lighters hiss and click, a spell, an incantation among young pines where Watcom Creek runs below the hush of wind in cedars. Now his friend, who has carried in secret a tattered sack from the Lummi Reservation, lifts a fountain firework, lights it, and summons a shower of sparks into the dry, white heat of June. How could they know, standing just feet from the creek's edge, that the water itself would burn? Sparks blossom on the current into a crest of flame, a rill of widening fire, their clothes effervescing, then their breaths, the needles of the pines incandescent. While not far from the office of the company whose pipeline had leaked, I look up from my homework, the windows of my grandmother's trailer shuddering in their crooked sills. Two boys, whose initials notched two desks at school, had discovered the secret leaking toward town. Had saved us all, the mayor said. Boys my own age, whose names stand on plaques in Whatcom Park, whose stories parents whisper like a warning. Stephen Siorvis, Wade King, they who called a secret forth into flame, who found a burning world inside our water. And then this second poem is called First Star, and it's kind of again about that expansion, I guess, beyond the world that some of these early poems have set up and introduced us to, and the world I grew up in. First Star. It is here, in the empty lot across from Kmart, dusk falling on the cusp of summer, that you realize you love her. She has asked you to teach her to drive. You lied about having a license, and your mother's Metro is not cut out for this. How she kills the clutch again and again as you brace your bodies against the dash, laughing. You were not cut out for it either. The way she jokes with the boys at your lunch table, grin flashing, hair black as volcanic glass. You cannot ease the ache her body makes in yours, no matter what you do, even when you are making love behind her mother's leaky apartment, or lying in the damp grass after, watching geese sign their mysterious arrow overhead. Soon her father will vanish again, her mother remarry and take her to Georgia. On the phone, she'll talk about pills she started, and a man she met at church, her voice fading in the sound of traffic. But blink now, and you are back in the empty lot. Blink, and you were in the brimming grass, wet, watching the geese neck ever on. Tell her again they have needles in their noses, like compasses, guiding them to where they must go. So you can see Sirius, the first star, though you know she is already sleeping, like something crash-landed, unfathomable, from an even deeper distance. Her breasts below the coat you both share, her wrists so defenseless that the world, for the first time, frightens you. And you begin, in that light, to know what it is.
I think I know why you won. The ache is in the ache is in the word, and the spirit is in the flesh. Your words are filled with spirit made flesh, if ever I heard any. The naming of things, so smart of you, the naming of people. I mean, Genesis started with the naming, right, in the Garden of Eden, and you capitalized on that so well. Why do you think they say you are so lyrical? What do you think the reasons are?
It's a combination of, I think, some of it being my early slam poetry background and spoken word, and how I think there's a kind of music in my work that seeped in through that.
You know, how do you do it, though? How do you get it on the page?
Gosh, you know, I compose often in a pretty verbal way, or and talking to myself, and you know, my I would show you, maybe I've got, I don't know, like a notepad here. This is, you know, we I don't know if you can really see, but it's
it's a mess, all right. That's a mess, all right.
Yeah, it's really
there's your voice. There's your voice on the page, all right.
Yeah, so you know the early drafts often have like arrows connecting different parts or side notes, or you know a lot of kind of false starts, and I think I'm trying to find oftentimes the music or the repeated sounds that will carry me through the poem, and you know of course I think the way poetry is sometimes taught, especially you know in high school or middle school, is like there are all these terms for elements of music like assonance or alliteration, as if a writer is sitting there kind of like consciously engineering those repeated sounds. But for me, it's more kind of rhythmic and intuitive. And it, you know, I'll read, you know, poets who sound often lyrical or have a certain music to their writing.
Yeah.
And that can kind of get me into this mindset. And the music, you know, in that poem, First Star, that I just shared, the poem itself is a prose poem. And so I think what kind of gives it form, if you will, is oral, you know, it's
right. But when it comes on the page, things happen. And I heard them happen. I heard you make pivots. I heard you make voltages. I heard you make shifts. I heard you change the measurement of the line because of that. And I've heard a short line and then I heard a long line. So I'm saying that what your voice has done, as Robert Pinsky called the pillar of breath, and none of us is alike the other person, is what I'm hearing. And so it's so interesting to me. You might want to write an essay about that. Before we go on, you went to the University of Houston and then Nebraska. So I would like you to take, just in a couple of sentences, take each one and tell me what you brought away from that. What did you learn from the University of Houston writing program?
Yeah,
what do you think?
those are
did you learn questions. To be nice to your friends? Did you learn to be quiet in the hallway? What did you learn?
Yeah, I learned those things, to be nice to my friends. You know, I had kind of fallen in love with poetry, as I said, through SLAM. And I didn't know a single person who had gone to school for poetry. I didn't know that even existed. I just liked what I was hearing on the microphone at, you know, an open mic here in Bellingham called Poetry Night that is now defunct, and in the Seattle Poetry Slam. And so I think in Houston, a lot of that was actually a process of kind of breaking down my writing. And for a couple of years, my first couple of years in Houston, I really didn't end up writing a whole lot. Unfortunately, I think, but also I think I was writing a lot of very short poems that were very formally conscious. I was really fascinated with like the line and lineation and all of these things that weren't really in the toolbox as a slam poet. And so I think for, you know, a few years after that, my writing wasn't, in my opinion, wasn't that great. You know, it was kind of in this in-between place, and it was sort of being broken down, and I was experimenting with all these things that I hadn't used much before.
Maybe it's better than you think. Maybe you shouldn't throw that away. It might be very good. You're at the University of Nebraska. Was that for an advanced degree? And did you meet Ted Kooser?
I did, yeah. It was for a PhD in poetry writing. And yeah, I did work with Ted quite a bit, actually. And, you know, my time with him, the teaching he was doing at the time, now he's retired from there, but it was basically, you know, the other students and I would jokingly call it TED Talks, because we would go into his office and it's just a one-on-one meeting and you just chat, and he'll look at your poem and, you know, kind of give you his thoughts. And it was very grounding, especially after the Houston experience, where I think I was growing a lot formally. Ted's questions were always like, well, what time of day is this? Or, you know, or like, oh, well, is this, you know, it's not clear who the you is in this poem. They were very like, kind of basic and focused on like accessibility or clarity, and very earthly grounded questions.
But a good combination, though, from formalism to the vernacular. You can't do better than that. Well, he's my boyfriend, you know. He'll always be my boyfriend.
Yeah,
so this is so here you are, a prize winner and loved and beloved by a lot of people already. And so I want to hear two more from you. This is the poet in the poem, and his name is Ryler Dustin.
Okay. So I will read, I guess, this poem next, called Wood and Wire, where the speaker, or myself really, has left the Pacific Northwest and started to kind of explore the broader world. This is about a strange experience I had while traveling, that, you know, many of us, I love that kind of disassociative odd space that being out of your familiar environment can put you in. So this is called Wood and Wire. In Edinburgh, I could not understand what the cab driver said as he drove me to the restaurant. And inside, the only person who would speak to me was a Lithuanian with pink hair who leaned above her wine and whispered, "Nothing is familiar." She had learned English in 10 months. She couldn't remember the day before because cheap ecstasy had scrawled so much calligraphy into her brain. On the pier that evening, two sunsets burned above the waves. Maybe the sky is mirrored so far north. She said she had forgotten to call her boyfriend, but didn't want to leave. She said she was building a violin, had won a grant for it, and once it was done, would ply wood and wire into new instruments no one yet knew how to play. A couple passed, and she pointed. "It is the cheeks, the breasts and ass, but especially the cheeks that make women more beautiful than men. A man is the sky, but a woman is the earth, generous and whole." Every morning, she could remember who she was, and some of the night before. Then her mind would loosen, loosen, she said, until everything goes like water. "Even my language has no name for this, though we have 12 words for love, its various pitches and distances, its songs of shifting range." She said she would not remember me, though she wanted to, and in her porch light held my jaw in her thin hand. So this next one kind of shows the speaker returning to the Northwest. And this was actually the last poem in the book that I wrote. I wrote it after the manuscript had been accepted, and Pittsburgh was kind enough to let me include it. And it kind of felt like a missing piece of this journey through which the speaker returns to the Northwest and kind of comes back home. So this is called Interstate 5. What remains of these lost deltas after the mills shut down? An art of disappearing. Black windowed bars, the towers of a closed factory still blinking their red lights to hide that no work's inside. For years, I drove past these roadside diners carved out of rain. Trailer parks lined with European trees. The truck stop where cigarette smoke drifts into the air like the crease in an old photo. After Vietnam, my father worked in such a place. A gas station where he could hide from his own father, sleeping among beer cans in the owner's storage loft. Wages and cheap rent in exchange for silent work pumping fuel for tourists southbound to California sun. I go north instead. I follow the seam of diminishing sky as firs crowd in to hem the highway. Low mist makes an iridescent sweat on asphalt. Ghost hint of gasoline as I pull off for the Exxon. Even now, I forget the Oregon law against pumping my own gas. I'm startled by the man who appears beside my truck. Young, buzzed hair already thinning. A vet, maybe, from more recent wars. He leans on my door, asks how much. Tattoos of flowers and a bullet like a weird chrysalis spill from his rolled up sleeve.
There's the bullet. There's the bullet in the wound. And how you make it work. all that tenderness, all that beauty, all that you get out of a tattoo. How? I can't imagine performance poetry as being an extension of this. I think it's its own thing, because nobody would want to say this loudly. Nobody could want to say this loudly. Tell me what you did as a slam poet.
That's a great observation, Grace. I think, you know, as a slam poet, I was never, in my opinion at least, I was never the most talented performer, really. I mean, I could read my poem, I could project, you know, but a lot of national level slam poets are, you know, have like an acting background or just kind of like ooze charisma. And
you represented Seattle on the world stage. What do you want, the universe?
No, I'm so honored by that. And that was an incredible experience, getting to represent Seattle and in the World Poetry Slam. And, you know, I think in the slam scene, I was kind of maybe known as someone who tended sometimes to write quieter poems or to read poetry and write for the page. Just as I think kind of now that I'm more on the page, I'm known as someone who's like the slam poet, kind of, or the former slam poet. So I've kind of been in the middle of the road for my whole career, which is a great place to be, I think, because each context has different things, I think, to teach us as
what
writers.
Do they have? What does each context have?
Well, slam, you know, I'm always so grateful to have come up in that, because your first priority as a slam poet is to say something that will really matter to some random person who is walking through the bar or the cafe when you're performing your piece. And, you know, and it can be humbling. And in my experience, it's still the best editor, the best quote unquote writing workshop I've ever had, is just getting up on the mic and reading a poem. Because at least in my experience, once you start reading and you've got other people in the room, especially people who are not like highly trained poets or graduate students who've invested, you know, all of this time into understanding poetry, it's kind of a reality check, and you end up cutting out a lot of the stuff in your poetry that might be sort of fancy or seem kind of impressive, but doesn't really come across clearly or doesn't connect with people.
That is excellent. That is excellent information.
Yeah.
Is wonderful. And then did you carry that knowledge forward with you?
Yeah, I did. And I think, you know, in my PhD in Nebraska, that was a time when I started to kind of rebuild my voice, I think, after Houston. And it was kind of a synthesis of those two traditions, as I had experienced them, at least.
Did that become your manuscript, your 2010 book of poems, your PhD manuscript?
No, actually, the 2010 book was before that, and that was almost entirely my slam stuff, and that was
Right
before.
Bloody. It's called Right Bloody.
That's the press, yeah. And there.
Oh no! What is it? No, the title is what?
Well, the title is Heavy Lead Birdsong.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the press is Right Bloody, and Right Bloody has gone on to grow and is a wonderful press and puts a really powerful like emphasis on what I was just describing of like, can your poetry grab someone, even someone who hasn't been trained to, you know, understand, quote unquote, understand poetry? Can you engage someone? Can you save someone's life through your words, you know, if you need to, or whatever? Wait,
that's a good test. It's the acid test.
Yeah.
Give us another poem and we'll see if you can save a person's life.
Okay, so maybe I shouldn't have set that bar.
No, I'm already saved. You got me.
Okay, wow. Well, thank you, Grace. So this, I'll actually read a poem for a spoken word hero of mine. That this one is in Trailer Park Psalms, the recent book from Pittsburgh, and it is in honor of and dedicated to a poet named Jack McCarthy, who was a huge mentor for many of us in the slam scene. When I met him, I think he was in his early 70s or late 60s, maybe. And all of us, you know, slam was still fairly new. And most of us were, you know, we were like in our early 20s. And he would get up to the mic and the whole room would just fall silent. And he would unfold these very measured kind of stories, really. I think he was as much a storyteller as a poet. And he was the first person I really looked up to who said, you know, there's something in your poems that is worth exploring more, and encouraged me to keep writing. So this is for him. It's called Visitation, for Jack McCarthy. Winter's skin breaks here into tractor scars and strip mall hues thrown back from the trash-pocked canal. Jack, I've come back to our old town, where branches ripe with dead hives sigh beside new apartments. Life's laws are darkly visible tonight, how the sight of wind-swept cedars makes an ache inside the marrow, and tracks of fugitive deer turned back by chain link blocking the creek. The coyotes you loved keep moving east, their eyes becoming windows on the hill, then washed out stars. A scientist says life reinvents the dead. What's lost is layered over but comes back in different forms. After you died, I dreamed I saw you running here, lungs finally clear, breath pluming past wet trees. You were done with writing, wanted only wind. It's cold tonight, Jack, too bitter to stay still. So I'll keep walking, watching snow begin over the bay. The mossy church they turned into a bookstore. The wild dogwoods by the ruined mill. Fat flakes like phantom blossoms, vanished blossoms, falling briefly back to earth.
That is so beautiful. So very beautiful. Now that you are an award winner, are you still willing to take risks? I mean, are you willing to give it all up to be experimental, to be new, or are you going to want to be safe?
Gosh, I mean, I definitely want to take risks. You know, I think probably most poets, I hope, you know, want to continue to take risks kind of wherever they are in their career. I think, you know, for me, I'm starting to kind of write brand new poems again after working on this manuscript a lot. And you know, I find that I have to take risks, because each time I start writing, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I feel
that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's like you're kind of reinventing even what a poem is each time. And, you know,
perfectly said. Maya Angelou said every time she looks at the page, she has no idea how to begin a poem. But Bob Hickok says, and I love his work, he says, the only risk is not taking a chance. Mm. So I do think, you know, once you become a prize winner and known for that, then I think you need to forget it, probably. Yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's a fine line, I think, between, you know, I think many writers spend their whole career with kind of one obsession. And I think that can be good. You know, that can be really deepening they can kind of go deeper and deeper throughout a lifetime. And in some ways we can't escape our obsessions. You know, I will probably always write about romantic love, about loss, or like the death of people I care about, probably write about place a lot. And those are things that are just kind of in me to write about. But I think, you know, you can also push yourself to try to write about them in a new way, or, you know, just kind of...
Or be willing to fail.
Yeah, be willing to fail. And, you know, what I try to remind myself and what I encourage my writing students to remain connected with is the fact that when you're working on a poem, it's not public yet. You know, you can write a poem and just then never show anyone,
That is so good. We just have to have things where nothing's at stake sometimes.
Yeah.
You know? And so everything's at stake for you because we love you. And so give us a final poem.
Okay. So, I'll share, let's see, I've got kind of a poem here that is, it's a really short one. It's just 8 lines. And
oh, well then give us two.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Well, I'll give you two final poems then, both short ones. This is called Love Poem with Stinging Nettles. And, I want to kind of give a shout out to my friends, Cameron and Kiernan, who are from my PhD program in Nebraska. Kiernan's an artist, Kiernan Laughlin, and Cameron Steele is another poet. And they've both been such dear friends to me, especially back then when we were all kind of writing. And
there's no friend like one with common consciousness. They're the best. Poets are the best.
Yes. So their wedding was kind of an original impetus for creating this. And I also want to give a shout out to my wife, Shannon, who is also, you know, the love of my life and kind of informs this poem too. So this is called Love Poem with Stinging Nettles. Flash where the gutter spills to the sunstruck runnel. Could we be this changeable and true? Today, a gray dawn hung in your hair, and in my ear, your breath sounded like this, a word the whole body believes. Noon flickers on undergrowth, crow bones blown down from an elm, and my heart, which knows for its home only wilderness, now chooses your wilderness, your hands red from nettles, slick with the milk of split thistles. And I've got one final poem I'll share with you, Grace. And this is a later poem in the book. And it's one I find myself reading almost every time I read from this book, because it's about my grandmother. And she is, you know, kind of behind the scenes in a lot of the poems here in this book. And she passed away when I was pretty young still. I think I was like maybe 11 or 12. But was such a huge part of my childhood and this place. So this is for her. It's called To Make Color. Every morning, my grandmother cleaned the Fisher stove in the back of our trailer, lifted ash in a shovel, careful not to spill the fine gray dust. Precious, she said, her breath smoking in the coal. Precious in winter's first lavender, not quite light, and you could smell it, the faintest acrid hint of ash, a crispness calling you from bed. You could watch her cap it in a chicory coffee can to stack among others, back bent from a long-gone fever. For the garden in spring, she said. Thank you, Grace.
The voice of Ryler Dustin. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, Rivada Foundation, Anne Arundel Arts Council, and friends of the program, Avide Shoshani, Natalie Canavor, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.